This is printed in 1700, and it is the Meditations of Augustine. And we can learn just by that, his works were in wide distribution in 1700. So someone like Jonathan Edwards probably would have a book very similar to this in his library and be able to go and to read. And we'll see the influence that Augustine will have on church history. But I'd just like to go, as we often do here in the class, and begin with the prayer. And I'm going to read from Augustine's Meditation on a Devout Prayer to Christ. So if you would join with me as we pray. My hope, my Christ, my God, Savior and lover of men, Thou light and way, Thou life and health, Thou glory and grace of all that love and serve Thee, look down from Thy throne of Thy majesty, and in the midst of bliss, remember the injuries and sufferings, the scourges and crosses, the wounds and death which Thou endurest, and think with favor on Thy supplant, for whose sake Thou wert pleased to endure and do so much. Thou art my living and true God, my Holy Father, my gentle and kind Master, my great King, my good Shepherd, my only Teacher, my most ready and effectual Helper, my dearest and most beautiful Spouse, my true and living Bread, my everlasting High Priest, my guide to my own country, my true light, my right way, my best wisdom, my holy delight, my unspotted purity, my reconciliation and peace, my sure defense, my most desirable portion, my eternal health and unbounded mercy, my invincible patience, my unblemished sacrifice, my perfect redemption, my assured hope, my universal charity, my resurrection from the dead, my everlasting life, my joy, my beatific vision, forever. Of Thee I beg that I may walk by Thee, come to Thee, rest in Thee. O Thou way, Thy truth, Thou life, without which no man comes to the Father, Thou, even Thou, art the blessing my soul wants and most earnestly desires, my sweetest, loveliest, only Lord. Amen. We can see the heart of Augustine in there, and that was just about the first quarter of that meditation on the loveliness of Christ. Well, we come to study Augustine, and we pick up, we see from his life, he will be born in November 13th, 354. He'll live until 76 years of age and die in August of 430. One author tried to summarize his life as a life searching for truth which would bring human fulfillment. And I think that is a good summary of Augustine. I want to just come up with a few thoughts here. As you read different biographies of Augustine, there's a lot who will say and argue, as David said last week, as I told him afterwards, raining on my parade, probably Augustine is the most influential man in church history that God has chosen to give us. But why would we say that? Why would we choose him over Edwards, or Calvin, or Luther, or Zwingli, or Knox, or on and on? Why him? Why just this one? Well, I think you could make an argument that the volume of his work. We have over 500 of his sermons in existence today. He wrote over 100 books. He had multiple papers. It was great volume, but a lot of other men and women have produced a lot of volume. We could probably talk about the fact of the impact or the influence of his work was so great. Some call him the influencer of the influential. Certainly you would go and you would find him, as I said earlier, I'm sure you found him in Edwards' library, in Calvin's library, and in Luther's library. And as you read these men, they all studied him, and they benefited from him and learned from him. It's also, it's quite strange, I really don't know how to balance all of this out, but every branch of Christianity claims him. The Roman Catholics claim him, the Lutherans claim him, the Anglicans claim him, the Reformed tradition in Geneva, Americans claim him. We all claim him, but whose is he? They all say he belongs to us. That's an interesting thought, but certainly we can see his influence in every branch of Christianity. F.F. Bruce, in his work, argues that when you come to the Reformation in the 16th century, what you find is the doctrine of Augustine's a doctrine of grace fighting with Augustine's doctrine of the church. Whether that's fair or not, we don't really know, but at least it tries to show you the impact that Augustine will have even in the 16th century Reformation and those that we hold. But this is just my opinion. I think really, though, in my mind, what makes Augustine probably the greatest influence in church history since the Apostle Paul is the originality of his work. Calvin and Luther and Edwards could go to their shelf and pull Augustine off and read it. To whom did Augustine go and pull off and read? And the answer to that is not very many. And so I think his influence is going to be because of his walk with God, the mind that God gave him, the experiences that developed him as a man and brought him to, by Christ's grace, conversion. All of those things are going to bring him to be what he is, the great impact upon the church. And so I think the reason why he's probably, if you can only read one biography in church history, time is so limited, I understand, you have so much else to read. Augustine, though, is worthwhile to read. It's his originality for what he has done and how God used him. Well, let's move then quickly as we go forward. Just a brief review here. You know, we divide church history into three main segments. It's really new, middle, and old, or I should say new, old, middle, and new. Sorry about that. Or ancient, medieval, and modern. We've picked just a few dates. You could come up with many different dates, but we saw in the ancient church, the apostolic church, when the apostles all died and passed on, we came to the apostolic fathers, those who rubbed shoulders with the apostles, and what they were going to do. We talked about the church councils a little bit. We may develop that even more coming forward. Augustine will have the benefit of some of this, but we come then to the golden age of the church fathers, which is where we are today. Going forward in the future, you will see, we'll get medieval church history and modern church history, but the golden age of church fathers is this pivotal period between the ancient church coming into the medieval church, and Augustine is going to be at this end time here. It's also, I think, fair to say that, as I referred to earlier, a lot of what's going to happen in the Roman Catholic Church, we're all going to claim him, but a lot of his doctrine of the church is going to spill over into medieval church history and have an influence on it, for good or for bad. Whether he was rightly interpreted or wrongly interpreted, he is going to have a big influence on the medieval church history. Well, the golden age of the church fathers, we've already talked about some others, Chrysostom and Jerome, we come then to Augustine. Augustine of Hippo, as he was also known. I want to go overview our lessons today. I want to talk about today, the cauldron of his conversion at 354 to 387. We're going to see what happened, the influences in his life of Africa and his parents and of his disposition, his education. We're going to see his conversion come about. And then we're going to, next week, God willing, look at his Christian service in the church, the latter half of his life, or the latter two-thirds of his life. We'll see him as a polemicist, a preacher. We'll come back and look at him as an administrator of the church, a theologian, and a philosopher. But during this time period here, after his conversion, but before his Christian service gets in, though it'll take 13 years to write, he wrote an influential work. Probably, if you've read one of his works, it's going to be his Confessions. And we can see this really as a pivotal middle point in who he is as an individual. He's going to talk about his conversion, but we're also going to see a theme develop in his conversion that is going to carry forward into all of his life. His spiritual pilgrimage is summarized here in his conversion, and we see it as a clue, an illustration of the universal situation of human beings in relation to God. And then that's going to impact his theology. One author has put it this way: his theme will permeate his thinking about every major problem he's going to face when he becomes a pastor. I want to read this. Bear with us and read it. Follow with me as I read it. Though the human self, this is the author trying to summarize Augustine's main point in the Confessions, though the human self is created for the knowledge and love of God and is unquiet, that is Augustine's word that you find in the Confessions, and he'll use that frequently, his soul is unquiet, until it comes to rest in God, it is also turned away from God and lost in a falsely directed love. While this perversion can be described, it cannot be accounted for. Augustine struggles with his evil for the first 30 years of his life, and he can't figure out why it is he loves evil so much and how he comes. He's going to seek everywhere he can to deal with it, except the one place that will answer it. He can't figure out why. And the human nature, he'll develop his theology that is going to come about and give an answer for it and then how to deal with it. But he's going to try a lot of other ways first. Its spring, that is, its fountain, the source of this evil, will lie deeper than the level of conscious choice. It goes to the very nature, to the warp and woof of who we are as human beings. Children are born dead in their sins. I will never have to train my son or my daughter or our children how to lie, lust, steal. They know that from the second they are conceived. It is in the very fabric of human nature. We have to really bust ourselves to teach them how to love and not to be selfish and how not to use their mouth. We have to work hard on that, but we don't have to train them how to do evil. It is in the very fabric of who we are. Its springs will lie deeper than the level conscious choice. By the same token, its rectification depends on an impulse which human choice cannot of itself provide. Only the grace and love of God, working in ways which cannot always be discerned or understood, can redirect human love. Human loving, and focus it on the ultimate source of its fulfillment, God. Now that is Calvinism at its heart. And you wonder where Calvin got it? I think you can see from just reading the Confessions it was going to have an influence. You see the doctrine of what in here? You see sin, you see grace, you see atonement is going to be taught and that you've got to have some other source to deal with it as he develops that. You can see so much of his theology as this author summarizes it in the Confessions. So today we're going to look at this, what I call the cauldron of conversion. We're going to see his philosophy develop. We're going to see him deal particularly with evil and how it comes about and what it happens and manifests itself in a life and then how it's dealt with. Next week we're going to look at the practice. He becomes a converted man and now he's going to have to go and live out his philosophy in the church and he's going to have great struggles. But he will be a pastor's pastor, not only a theologian and philosopher. He will deal with everyday problems in the church. We're also going to see that he's an administrator, and he will actually sit as a judge in a court. They didn't have courts and judges like you and I do today. He will be a judge, administering and giving judgments in a legal setting as well. He had a man with much responsibility, and I can't imagine all of the burdens that he wore, but he had a pastor's heart, and he'll bring that to bear in the everyday practice of people's lives. We'll see today his interior search for the truth. Next week, God willing, the practice problems of the church, the practical problems of the church you'll have to deal with. Well, David asked a question last week. I had to think about it. I believe it was you were talking about Calvin, and Calvin struggled with, pray tell, how was it that Augustine could come up with the theology, the accurate theology that he did, having his allegorical interpretation of the scriptures that he did. Calvin would sit here, I think, and say, I'm postulating, that Augustine's hermeneutical principles were all messed up. He had it wrong. And yet he got it so right in his theology. How, pray tell, did he do that? Well, my theory is, I don't know, you can argue with it maybe, but my theory, and why Calvin didn't come up with it, I don't know. He's a lot smarter than I am, to say the least. But as I sat there and pondered that question, I thought, because he lived an evil life, he wrestled so hard with it, and God so thoroughly saved him from it, even if his hermeneutical principle was not perfect, he was able to come up with the right theology. And I think it came out of the practice of his life. And that's why he got it so right. What do you think, David? Sound good?
That sounds really
good. Should we write a book about it, brother?
if I can be the contributor, you be the lead author.
Oh, no. I know better than that.
David will sell the book.
He'll sell the book, yeah. You mark it. There you go. That'll work. Well, anyway, let's talk a little bit about the influence of Africa. This is obviously not the Africa in his day, but if you were to look at modern Africa today and a map of it, and I don't know how accurate this is even today, but for the most part, we're going to find that Augustine is going to be born and raised in this part right in here, which is modern-day Algeria, near Tunisia, where Carthage is, would have been located today next to west of Libya. If you were to look in a map more reflective of his day, you would see that this is Italy. It's hard for me, and I apologize if I put my back to you and you can't see. Holler. This is Italy right here, kicking the football of Sicily into the coast of Africa, coming across modern-day Spain here. We'll find Numidia and Muritina, that area there. And so you come to Carthage and Hippo. This will be the area of influence in North Africa. Now, I have not come up with new archaeological discoveries with pictures of Augustine, but what I have tried to do is to give you some representations of what he may have looked like. We know that he was a Numidian from North Africa. His mother was of Berber descent. We know that he was neither African nor European. The Berbers were going back 5,000 years from this time, coming into North Africa from the east. We know that there was Berbers who reigned in Egypt in 4,000 B.C., so it goes back a long time, but they were not indigenous necessarily to North Africa. They came from the east. He was a Berber. They said, and he described himself and others that we know, he was tall and long-limbed, thin-chested and with sloping shoulders, a long nose, high forehead, thick lips, and large black eyes. His skin was dark bronze. The middle picture you have right there is a 15th century rendition, Catholic of looks of what they thought of he might have looked like. The other two pictures on either side are as old of pictures as I can find of those from a Berber descent. And you can see North African Berbers here. You can see that they are neither European nor African. They have dark skin, big nose features there. At least you can do a Google search and put in Berber pictures and see what you come up with. That's what I did and was able to come up with. He's going to grow up in North Africa, which knew a greater day. Back in the 4th century B.C., Carthage almost came to take over the Roman Empire and rule the world. It was a rich culture. It was a well-established culture. And you can see the shaded areas along the coast here were the predominant areas of Carthage and its empire going over into Spain and Sardinia and Sicily. You remember that Hannibal in the 4th century almost conquered Rome, got down to very near Rome. And it was almost going to change the history of the world because had Carthage taken over and Rome had fallen, North Africa would have been the center of the world and not Rome. And who knows what God would have done in such a scenario, but North Africa would have been the center of Christianity potentially, and North African history would have been, or African history would have been substantially different, European history altered, and the history that we know and have come from many of us ourselves through the English Reformation and the Reformed Baptist, who knows what would have happened had Hannibal succeeded. But nevertheless, this was the high point about 700 years, I guess you would say, before Augustine was going to come. Ponder that a time. 700 years is a long time. Carthage, which was going to be the city that Augustine will go to get his education, which was the center of North Africa. It was a very proud, large city for the standards of that day. It was a seaport. It was originally settled by the Phoenicians. It had been a great threat to Rome and almost defeated. It was a large seaport, cosmopolitan lifestyle. It became a Roman colony. It had a Colosseum like the one that you would find in Italy. It had baths and forums. And if you would have walked through Carthage, you would have found very much life like it would have been in Rome. It would have had much the same flavor of what you would have seen in Rome. Wild beast shows, chariot races, all of those things. It would have been influenced by that. But by the 4th century, it was in great decline. It was a backwater. It was some place you wanted to escape. It was still a seaport area and influenced by that. But it was not, shall we say, the up-and-coming area, and it struggled greatly. Now, the city, either Thagaste or Tagaste, or there's many different pronunciations of it and spellings, was under the influence and control of Carthage. This was the city that Augustine was born in. It was 150 miles from the sea. It was 2,000 feet high. I do that because we always think of Africa. You might have some kind of envision of either desert or rich, dense jungle. This was not it. It was more of a higher elevation, 2,000 feet high. It had forests and pines and farms, and his city was a Roman colony, loyal to Rome, obviously operating under the influence of the government in Carthage. Brown will say this, Peter Brown, probably if I were to recommend a biography of Augustine, his would be the one that I would recommend. He says of Augustine in this area in North Africa, Augustine will grow up in a hard, competitive world among proud and impoverished gentlefolk. and a classical education was the only passport out of this life in Carthage. Well, let's talk a little bit about his family. He's going to be born to Patricius, or as we would say today, Patrick, would have been his father. He was a landowner and a farmer, not a very large farm and not a very prosperous farmer, but nevertheless a landowner and a farmer. He owned land. He wasn't a slave. He had some nobility to him. He was a member of the ruling class in Thagais, but he was not wealthy. And we see clearly that he was living outside of his means. He was trying to have that noble lifestyle and that influence, sitting in the gates, but he didn't have the means to back it up. And that would be a great source of struggle in his family. Out of pride of his class standing, he wanted his son Augustine to succeed, but he showed little interest in his son. And this will be a black spot in Augustine's life. His relationship with his father, you can only describe as sad, as barren, as dearth. It was terrible. He allowed Augustine to do as he pleased, and he cared nothing at all about his morals. He just wanted him to be a son that would make him proud and worthy of their standing. Some believe Patricius had been unfaithful to Monica. Whether that's true or not, we're not sure. But certainly we know this. I love this summary. He never beat her, and like many husbands in that day. So at least, though the marriage was strained, it wasn't awful in that sense of the word of beating her. Patricius. We come to Monica, probably the most famous mother in church history, I think it's fair to say. Let me summarize. Brown says this of Augustine. Here I try and get a sense of that sadness. Augustine, a man of many significant silences, will pass over his father coldly. He was generous, but hot-tempered, that is, his father. Patricius had been immoderately proud of his son. He was admired by all for the sacrifices he made to complete Augustine's education. Augustine records in his Confessions a scene in the baths in which his father delighted to find that his son had reached puberty. All that the son will say, that is, Augustine, in return, is that he sees in me only hollow things. Patricius died just after he'd scraped together enough money to send his son to Carthage. Augustine, who will soon experience and express deep grief at the loss of a friend, will mention his father's death only in passing. He could lose a friend and suffer greatly, but lose his father and not shed a tear. That tells you a lot about his relationship, and it's got to be a sad thing in his life. Monica. We come to Monica. She was 23 years old when he was born. She was a Berber, we know. We're not sure about his father, though there's debate on both sides of that. But we know that she was a Berber, and that when she spoke her Latin that she learned, not her native tongue, she spoke it with a very heavy accent. So that's how we know she was a Berber and not from someplace else. She was restrained and dignified, above gossip, a firm peacemaker, capable of effective sarcasm, though, Augustine will say, and she will use it effectively on him. She was raised in a Christian family, and so she has deep Christian roots and was a committed, faithful Christian. She lived the Christian life. She was given to dreams. We have many of them recorded. Augustine will talk about her dreams. Influential in her husband's conversion, and I have a question mark here. Augustine speaks very little about his father. He does say in his Confessions that shortly before he died, he was a catechumen, that he had started attending the church and going through that process. But in praising his mother, he says that she, by her good graces and her loving disposition, won both her husband and her mother-in-law to Christ. That's the only word that we have. Now, it's very strange to me that Augustine, a converted man, I can see him in his bad relationship as an unconverted man, but as a converted, gracious man that Augustine was, why could he not reflect back upon his father and with any grace at all say something kind or even go into a little bit more detail about his father? Instead, he says virtually nothing. And so we don't know whether he was converted except for the cryptic comments praising his mother about how she was used by Christ to win her father. Nevertheless, that's the home life that he was going to be raised. She was committed to giving her children a classical education. She was an all-absorbing mother, almost smothering her son. And I say that probably maybe to a weakness, but God is going to use it in Augustine's life. But she smothered Augustine. Obviously, we know the stories that she was faithful to pray for her conversions more than even a dead son. One priest said, or Augustine actually said, that my mother prayed for me and wept more for my salvation and over my spiritual condition than most mothers will weep over their dead children. She literally wept and sobbed over his spiritual state, more so than mothers over dead children. You all know the story. A son of so many prayers and tears cannot be lost, a priest told her. And the faithful mother who travails with him in spirit with greater pain than her body had bringing him into the world was privileged to see her son saved shortly before her death. She would travail even more than childbirth over his spiritual birth. And so this really is a brief, certainly not a good summary of Monica, but time won't give us more time to go into detail. But there's much that you can read about Monica, or just reading his confessions will give us more details if you want to pursue that further. Augustine has an older brother, Navigus. He has older sister or sisters. We really don't know exactly. Some will say he had multiple sisters. Some will only say one sister. He never mentions the name of a sister. He never talks about the sisters. We know it from other references about a sister. It is true, one of the, I don't know whether you want to call weaknesses, one of the struggles that Augustine has early on, he develops a very immoral lifestyle, but the end of his life will be marked as a Christian of a very, I don't want to say an inferior view of women, but a very standoffish view. Except for his mother, which he obviously was loving attached and adored her, he never mentions his sisters. We're going to see that when he is a pastor, he will never allow a woman in his presence alone. Even his own family, his sister or his mother, would not be allowed in his presence alone. It's an oddity. I don't know what else to say. It's an oddity of Augustine, but he had a reason for it, and that would be the way that he would treat women going forward. We don't know anything about a sister or sisters in detail, just that he had siblings. Now, I take this from Augustine's confessions, and I try to summarize a little bit about his own view of his family. During the 16th year of my age, I lived with my parents, having a holiday from school for a time. He comes home. This idleness imposed upon me my parents' straitened finances. His parents couldn't afford for him to stay in school. He comes home at the holidays, and so he's writing about it. This will be also the time period where the famous story about stealing the pears comes from. Is in this context here. The thorn bushes of lust grew rank about my head, and there was no hand to root them out. Indeed, when my father saw me one day at the baths and perceived that I was becoming a man and was showing the signs of adolescence, he joyfully told my mother about it as if already looking forward to grandchildren, rejoicing in that sort of inebriation in which the world so often forgets thee, its creator, and falls in love with thy creature instead of thee. Note, by the way, this is a prayer. The confessions are a prayer to Christ, and he's talking to Christ, and that's the context here. The inebriation of that invisible wine of a perverted will which turns and bows down to infamy. But in my mother's breast thou had already begun to build thy temple and the foundation of thy holy habitation, whereas my father was only a catechumen, and that but recently. There's the mention. You're getting to almost the full knowledge of what he's going to mention about his father, only a catechumen, and that but recently. She was therefore startled with a holy fear and trembling, for though I had not yet been baptized, she feared those crooked ways in which they walk who turn their backs to thee and not their faces. Clearly you see the distinction between the father and the mother and the home life and what was viewed, as Augustine summarizes it in his Confessions. A little more here, if you'll bear with me. I read only because these are Augustine's words in his summary, and I think it's helpful. I also hope it will give you a taste to go and pull down the confessions again or go and buy them and read them for the first time. And although she knew that my passions were destructive, now he's talking about his lifestyle and his mother's response to it, and particularly his fornication, how marriage would have seemed a natural way to deal with it, but his mother had a different plan. And although she knew that my passions were destructive, even then, and dangerous for the future, she did not think they should be restrained by the bonds of conjugal affection, if indeed they could not be cut away to the quick. She took no heed of this, for she was afraid lest a wife should prove a hindrance and a burden to my hopes. It's interesting that she is going to press very hard for him to get an education. And she thought his education would serve as a means to his salvation. Marriage would not be the way to stem his lust and his fall into sin over and repeatedly, but education would be. The one thing that I can say to that is that the priest, remember that priest who said, I can't imagine any son not being saved who's had so many tears fall for him. He encouraged her, let him read, let him get educated, and let that be the source of his conversion. As he reads the Bible and learns knowledge, don't you try and chain him. Maybe it was his influence, but nevertheless, she didn't. This is what her intentions were. These were not her hopes of the world to come, which my mother had in thee, but the hope of learning, which both my parents were too anxious that I should acquire. My father wanted me to get an education, because he had little or no thought of thee, and only vain thoughts of for me. My mother, because she thought the usual course of study would not only be no hindrance, but actually a furtherance towards my eventual return to thee, O Christ. This much I conjecture, recalling as well as I can the temperaments of my parents. Meantime, the reins of discipline were slackened on me, so that without the restraint of due severity, I might play at whatsoever I fancied, even to the point of dissoluteness. And in all this there was the mist which shut out from my sight the brightness of thy truth, O my God, and my iniquity bulged out, as it were, with fatness. They let him run free, hoping education would get a hold of him. His father wanted him to get an education because he wanted a son to be proud of, that would do him right, that would be of the noble class and be fitting for their station in life, to be what he was not going to be rich and famous. She thought education would be the means that Christ would use for his conversion. Well, let's talk a little bit about his disposition. We've seen North Africa. We've seen his family life. Let's talk about who he was, how God wired him. What were his strengths? Well, first of all, we see he was physical and athletic. He loved to play games, whether they were physical games or board games, shell games. He loved competition. Tells you a little bit about who he was and his drive. He loved to accomplish and achieve and win, and he hated to lose. There's a lot of stories he talks about, even his confessions, of boys who beat him and then paid the price. Because he would hit him with rocks or hit him with his fist. He hated to lose. He was passionate and ambitious, constantly seeking for a purpose in life. Everything he tackled, he was going to win and accomplish. He had a clear mind. He was a strong thinker from the earliest of ages. And his parents saw it and recognized it. And thus, the desire for a good education, even to the point that they would stress their finances to get him a good education. He had strong affection for his mother. Yeah, not diligent in his studies as a boy, but later he would burn himself up with the fury to know all things. And he would be relentless in his pursuit of knowledge and the mastery of intellectual pursuit. What were his weaknesses? Well, he had a few. He was easily hurt. He had a grand pride about him, and it could easily be stepped on. He had an ungovernable temper, and he was known for that. He was a prolific and a proficient liar, and he talks about it in a large degree in his confessions. He knew how to lie and to get his way out of anything. Matter of fact, he was such a good rhetorician, he would say that being a rhetorician, that is, an orator in the Roman sense of the word, he was so good at it because they weren't worried about the truth. They were only worried about the presentation. And he could lie about anything and convince you he was right. And he was good at it. He was a great thief, he was proud, and he was full of lust. This describes who he was and his disposition and some of his weaknesses. Again, going to his confessions, bear with me as I read a little bit. But what was it that delighted me save to love and to be loved? Still, I did not keep the moderate way of the love of mind to mind, the bright path of friendship. Instead, the mists of passion steamed up out of the puddly concupiscence of the flesh and the hot imagination of puberty, and so obscured and overcast my heart that I was unable to distinguish pure affection from unholy desire. Both boiled confusedly within me and dragged my unstable youth down over the cliffs of unchaste desires and plunged me into a gulf of infamy. Thy anger, speaking to Christ, had come upon me, and I knew it not. I had been deafened by the clanking of the chains of my mortality, the punishment of my soul's pride, and I wandered farther from thee, and thou didst permit me to do so. By the way, do you see good theology in that? He permitted me to leave him. God gave me up to what I wanted and let me go, and I wandered further and further and further. He just gave me more rope and gave me what I wanted and turned me over to it. Pelagius will stumble over this. The confessions will be, he'll read that and probably pass out. And we'll see that, Lord willing, next week. I'm sure he didn't like this. I was tossed to and fro and wasted and poured out, and I boiled over in my fornications, and yet thou didst hold thy peace, O my tardy joy. Thou didst still hold thy peace, and I wandered still farther from thee into more and yet more barren fields of sorrow, in proud dejection and restless lassitude. Beautiful, isn't it? You can see it was a communicator and trained to communicate with the spoken and written word. Robert Payne says of Augustine's early years, he would reveal an intense, proud, and sensual man who yearned to know truth. Quite a combination, isn't it? He had an unquenchable desire for knowledge, but he had a lot of baggage that he was carrying with him. Well, let's talk a little bit about his education that he's going to receive. We'll go through the timeline up at the top in just a minute, but Augustine will be educated to become a master of the spoken word. He was a rhetorician. As I said, truth didn't really matter. It was the way you presented what you were going to do. And in Latin, that was the key, was your presentation. You wanted to be able to state things in such a way that you can convince anybody of anything. And that's what he was trained to do. His education was thoroughly pagan, lacking in Greek studies, steeped in Latin and ancient classics. Jerome would later nail him for this and really make fun of him, that he was an uneducated fop. And really, they would exchange harsh words over that. Augustine would work hard the rest of his life to overcome his weaknesses in his education. Being trained in the Latin school, he was trained to speak and communicate, not so much to think. The ideal product of this Latin education was the orator, a man who could give pleasure throughout his argument by his vivacity and by the feelings at his command, by the ease with which the words came to him, perfectly adapted to dress his message in style. That's how Brown summarized his education. In the usual course of this syllabus, we're going to see, though, that is, he's following a classical education of a Latin, and he was going to reach a book written by Cicero. Its style was admired by almost all, though its message was ignored. Typical Latin. We liked what he said and how he said it. We're not sure what he said, but he sure did move us. This book, however, contained an exhortation to philosophy. It is called the Hortensius. We don't have the book today. It's lost. We only have a few fragments of it. But it is going to be really what we're going to say starts Augustine on his quest for Christ. He's got a long ways to go, but it's going to unite a flame in him. This book indeed changed all my way of feeling, he says. It changed my prayers to thee, O Lord. It gave me an entirely different plan and aspiration. Suddenly all empty hope for my career lost its appeal, and I was left with an unbelievable fire in my heart. Desiring the deathless qualities of wisdom, I made a start to rise up and return to thee, O Christ. I was on fire, my God, on fire to fly away from earthly things to thee. You read Hortensius. The passion of that book was to gain knowledge and truth. And all of a sudden, Augustine was alive to this, and he wanted to know and to seek knowledge. He's going to find it and try and find it, I should say, in many different places and not in the Bible and in Christ. But it will mark who he is from that point on in reading that book as one who wants knowledge. He turns to the Bible after reading this book, but he finds it cold and meaningless. He found it crude as he read the Old Testament. He rejected it as inferior literature and put it aside. He turns to Manichaeanism, but its offer of truth to deal with his problem. Remember now, Augustine is coming alive to the fact that he knows he's an evil man. He is overcome with how evil he is. He turns to the Bible. He sees its answer to the Bible. He doesn't like it as literature, rejects it, and he doesn't like its answer to his problem of evil. But he turns to others, and first he's intrigued by what the Manichaeanism is going to teach him about how to deal with evil and the source of evil. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Let's just talk about his timeline here. He's born in 54. He's going to be sent away by his parents to a small town to the south of him to go to school. He will have to return, though, because of finances. They can't continue to support him. They've stretched themselves too far. He returns home. This is when he falls into the sin that we've talked about and the things that we've read about. His father scrapes up, though, enough money to send him back to the big city of Carthage. It would be like going to Harvard or Yale of North Africa. It was the elite education. His father was going to do whatever it takes to get him there, and he does. He goes to Carthage, but it's here that when he gets into the big city, his father has just recently died a few months before he gets to Carthage. His father is gone, his mother is out, and he's in the big city. And he is going to go wild, and he does. He'll take a concubine. He'll have her for a number of years, and he loved her, and he will have a son by her. It's another strange oddity in Augustine. I don't know how to explain it. Later we'll see that she'll be put away into a monastery. He will never marry her. His son will die when he's in his late teens, and we don't even know her name. We know so very little about her, but he lived with her for years, had an adorable son that was dear to his heart, and yet he just cuts her off like that after his right before his conversion, and never follows up with her. I don't know what else to say. It's an oddity and a strange thing about Augustine, and it goes back to, I think, his view of his struggle with sins. 372, he becomes a Manichae. He's going to return to Thagaste again. Here, Monica is going to find him so overcome in his sin that she puts him out of the home, and he is not allowed to return to the home. He's kicked out of the home. And he will go then, stay there for a while, and then return to Carthage to teach rhetoric, having completed his education. Well, let's go to his conversion. When he returns to Carthage, he is going to come to a conclusion that this is not satisfactory for me. Bright mind, has a great desire, very ambitious, he's proud, and he wants to accomplish things, and Carthage just isn't going to cut it for him. What's the next big step? How do I climb the ladder of upward mobility? I go to Rome. So his students in Carthage also were a real disappointment to him. They don't pay very well, so he moves on. We get an interesting story here. Before he leaves Carthage to go to Rome, Monica has moved to the city. She's come back now. She'd kicked him out of the home, but now she moves to Carthage for the sole purpose of keeping an eye on him and trying to restrain him in his sin. Again, this smothering influence. When he decides to go to Rome, he tells Monica, and she throws a fit. She absolutely refuses to let him go to Rome. And so he steals away. He goes and gets on a boat without even telling her. He really lies to her and fools her. She gets up the next morning, and he's gone. Got on the boat and has fled to Rome without her. Can only imagine what that would have done to her heart. He arrives in Rome. He's well known. He has a reputation. He comes, and he's given an audience to the Roman prefect, Symmachus. Basically, this would have been like a governor. Not the emperor of the empire, but the head of the Roman city. And it's his Manichaean ties that give him this entree to Symmachus. He is a pagan. He has Manichaean leanings. Ambrose, who is Symmachus's cousin, is seeking to bring in Christian influence, and Symmachus, according to the Senate in Rome that's still meeting there, is saying, look, you got to do something about this Ambrose. He's even putting up churches in Rome, and we've got to stop it. We need to deal with him. And so his way of dealing with him is that he's going to appoint Augustine to a position in Milan in rhetoric and influence to try and promote paganism where Ambrose is promoting Christ. An interesting contrast. by the way, we know the story, Ambrose is going to win. Symmachus was looking to appoint a teacher, this influential position, and Augustine is the one that gets it. Now we come then to his search for truth. Now I want to categorize or summarize, let me better say, to the search for truth since reading Hortensius. He describes his search for truth in his confessions as a vagabond mind. His mind will be wandering from place to place looking for truth. From the age of 12, note 12, seriously looking for truth, he'll try astrology, which he did for a period of time. He will go to philosophy early on, but he doesn't find real interest in that. He will go to paganism and join pagan cults. When he goes to Carthage for the first time and he goes into debauchery, one of the things that he does is he enters into the temple worship of the goddesses of Carthage. They had goddesses that oversaw the city and the chief goddesses. And he will enter into the temple worship with the prostitution and do it with great fervor and with a form of religion. And talks about that in his confessions. I dared to roam, he writes of this time, the woods and pursue my vagrant loves beneath the shades. Lord, how loathsome I was in thy sight. Lust stormed confusedly within me, he said, whirling my thoughtless youth over the precipices of desire. And so I wandered still further from thee, and thou didst leave me to myself. The torrent of my fornications tossed and swelled and boiled and run over. He's got good words, doesn't he? He can communicate well. And he summarizes his life up to that point. From 19 to 31, we're going to see him try Manichaeanism. Really, David has already talked about this. Remember, its chief teaching was trying to explain evil. And it does it by material is evil and non-material is good. And Augustine is taken up, but he doesn't find it very convincing, and he meets with the leaders, and he'll reject that. He will go to Neoplatonism, very, very close to his conversion, after he moves to Rome. But that's not going to satisfy him, and then he ends up into skepticism. He will basically be agnostic for a period of time. I don't know what is truth and where to find it. And so you can see this path that he is going to go on. God is bringing him through all of these things so that he will be able to say with a clear voice where truth is found and what it does. One author summarized it as an interior search for truth and an absorption in worldly and sexual gratification as a way to summarize him before his conversion. But he will be converted in July of 386. Some say September. We're a little sketchy, but we know it was the summer to early fall of 386. That'll be brought to Christ. What were the circumstances of his conversion? Well, just from the background, I would say, certainly the influence of his mother. Not only her prayers, but remember, she would have read the Bible, and there would have been a lot of rebukes and reminders of Scripture that would still have been in his mind. He had a very cogent mind, and he had a steel-trap mind. And all of those things his mother would have been saying to him over all those years, though he was gritting his teeth as she was talking to him, no doubt would have stuck with him and would be used by the Holy Spirit to come back. The intense desire for truth and a serious intellectual pursuit. He was a serious seeker of knowledge. And he would fall headlong into everything he would find worthy to try and find truth. That will be help. He also had a great sense of his evil nature. You did not have to ever convince him that he was an evil man. When Ambrose would have contact with him and he would start attending church, as David said last week, to just hear him preach. Remember, what was important to him as a rhetorician was the presentation, not the contact. Ambrose was the leading preacher in Italy. He wanted to go and hear his presentation, and he would go to hear how he preached, not the content, but the style. But then he started to imbibe some of the content as well, and it was going to begin to cause him to be unsettled. But he was taken with Ambrose. Ambrose would have interaction with him, but Ambrose would actually not farm him out or push him off. But his right hand, Ambrose's right hand man, would take Augustine under his wing and counsel with him. And Augustine would try and get him off, he says, into rabbit trails and talk about theology. And the friend of Ambrose would bring Augustine back to the real issue of the day, his heart and his evil. And he says, I would not let Augustine get me sidetracked. Whenever we were together, I always brought him back to his evil, his sin, And he had to wrestle then with what was he going to do with his sin, because everything he tried, Manichaeanism, philosophy, his paganism, none of it dealt with this evil that he was aware of, and it would be used greatly to drive him to Christ. Well, we saw already the alternatives to Christianity, his Manichaeanism, he rejected it, his Platonism or Neoplatonism, he will reject that. But what were the circumstances of his conversion in Milan in 386 when he's going to be saved by Christ? Well, first of all, he'd reached the pinnacle of his profession. Remember I said he left Carthage? He wanted to climb the next ladder of success because of his ambition and his pride. He comes and he gets it. He gets appointed by the prefect of Rome to the top position for a rhetorician. He gets it. He's there. He is the CEO. He's in charge. He's at the pinnacle. He has wealth now. Money's starting to flow in. He's got that Roman salary coming in. He's going to be paid as a government official. He has popularity. His name is being spread abroad. He has, when he comes to Rome, Symmachus knows who he is already from North Africa. He had popularity. Friends. He had a villa. A beautiful house. I mean, he basically has the American dream. He's got it all right here as we would describe it. But he wasn't satisfied. He says, I was panting after honors and profits and marriage, but none of it was satisfactory to me. He's forced to give up at this time period his mistress of 15 years, not because of his conversion. This is another odd thing. I don't know how to explain it. But Monica made him give up his mistress, his concubine, of 15 years, who had fathered his son, who he loved dearly, so that she could arrange a marriage to a girl he couldn't marry because she was not even a teenager yet, so that he could have a higher social standing. And he went along with it. And I think he saw from his perspective, you know, I'm here, I'm at the top of my pinnacle, but I got a concubine and I haven't got a marriage that brings me into the social circles that I need to run in with any kind of acceptability. And so he sends her away. But he loved her. It really was his wife, his bondmate. It was his friend. And it devastates him. And so he is an emotional mess now. So he's dissatisfied. He's finding no fulfillment. He loses the love of his life. In order to gain, he gives her up to gain something that's going to mean it'd be meaningless to him anyway. It's an unusual setting. He'd become a Neoplatonist at this time, but then he's kind of shocked when he finds out that the leading Neoplatonist of his day rejects it and becomes a Christian. And it casts all kinds of doubt in his mind, and he says, okay, I give up. I'm just going to be a skeptic. And he goes into a form of agnosticism filled with doubts. He comes under the preaching of Ambrose during this time, and he's struck by the certainty of the truth and the answers to the problem of evil given in his sermons. He says, uh-oh, I've struggled with evil. I've tried to find so many different things to deal with it. And Ambrose has the answer, and it's in the Bible. He was also struck by his style and how Ambrose, remember what's important to a rhetorician is the style. Ambrose's preaching, as David I think said last week, enabled him to see the Old Testament as beautiful. And he began to see through the power of the preached word the beauty of the Scriptures and how God intends to use them in the lives. And it becomes alive to him, and once again, he begins to turn back to the Scriptures that he had known from an early age and even read early on before turning away from them. It's interesting to note, and we'll read it just a minute, about the day he was converted. What do we find on the table that was set up for dominoes to be played with? We find the epistles of Paul. He was reading them, and that's going to be instrumental, I think, in his conversion, obviously. He's going to get a visitor named Pontian, who is going to come. He had lots of visitors. He's a high government official, beautiful villa, entertains a lot, lots of friends. He loved to have people coming in. He has a visitor who comes from North Africa, and he's going to challenge Augustine to take up the monastic life in chastity. And he's struck by it, and he begins to ponder what he is telling him, and he begins then to wrestle, but then I have to give up my ambition and my physical pleasure. And so he says this, he prays in his confessions that famous phrase, Lord, give me chastity and continence, but not now. I need it, I want it, I know it's the right thing, but I don't want to do it now. You can see there. You almost feel the wrestling in his heart. He has this evil. He knows truth. Now what does he do? Well, let me just read, because I can summarize better, I think, the day that he was converted by a story. This is a crass plug again. You can go and get these things. You can go and Christian history. This one is well worthwhile. You can see I mark it up and read through them. They're really a good summary. You can go. I think it's like $3. You can buy this. It's worth having. All the different characters. You can get so many of them when they focus on them. I'd encourage you to go to the website and order them. They're not expensive. In this section, Why Not Now, he records now, the author here, Peter Brown, basically wrote this summary for this article here about Augustine, and I'm going to go to the day of his conversion. As Augustine tells the story, the day began ordinarily enough. He was staying in his villa with Alypius and his mother, his friends from Africa and his mother. There came a visitor, an officer of the imperial household called Pontician, an African. They sat down to talk, and suddenly Pontician observed a book lying on a table that had been marked out for a game of dominoes. Pontician opened the book idly and was surprised to discover that it contained the epistles of Paul. Delighted, he spoke of his own conversion, of Antony and the anchorites of Egypt, then of the monasteries of Italy, and particularly of the monastery outside the walls of Milan, where Ambrose sometimes officiated. Pontician praised the ascetic life and told the story of two of his friends, who, upon reading the life of St. Anthony, determined to join a monastery. Some days later, the women to whom they were betrothed had also become Christians and were dedicated to virginity. Augustine was more moved than he had ever been in his life, especially by the thought of young brides committing to chastity. It seemed to him, at last, that he was being compelled to confront himself, seeing himself foul, crooked, and defiled with the habit of lechery, and now there must be an end to it. When Pontician was gone, Augustine turned to Alypius, his friend, who had come with him from North Africa. "What's the matter with us?" he exclaimed. "Yes, what is it? Didn't you hear? Simple men take heaven by violence, but we are heartless and learned. See how we wallow in flesh and blood? Are we ashamed to follow because others have gone before and not ashamed not even to follow? See the pride? Others have done it, but we must be different. Are we ashamed to follow where others have gone? Is it our pride that's going to keep us from this?" His mind was on fire. Alypius could hardly recognize him, so changed was his expression. And when Augustine threw himself out of the house, Alypius followed him closely, perhaps afraid of the harm he may do to himself. Resting in the garden, Augustine found himself confronted again with the problem of the will. Pelagius is coming to mind here as you think about this. The old temptations returned, more cunning than ever. Since he'd left and fled, struggling with his evil, he's all of a sudden being tempted again to evil. He says, "The old temptations returned, more cunning than ever, until he could hear the presence of Alypius no longer, and flung himself weeping out of the garden, finding solitude under a remote fig tree. There he babbled like a child, crying, 'How long? How long? Tomorrow? Tomorrow? Why not now? Why should there not be any end to my uncleanness now?'" You can hear him questioning himself in his evil. Almost he expected to hear God summoning him out of the clouds, but the voice he heard came from an unknown child chanting, tole lege, take up and read. So Augustine, these words came like an angelic visitation. No longer weeping, he rose to his feet and ran to the place where Alypius was sitting with the epistle of Paul beside him. Augustine opened the book, and his eyes fell on the verse from the epistle to the Romans where Paul demands that the servant of Christ should renounce all voluptuous pleasure. Isn't this, this is, as they say, one author, one lecturer I heard said, we don't recommend anybody to do this. Mm-hmm. Don't put your finger on a text, just open it and start reading. But that's what Augustine did. And what was the verse that his eyes fell to? Romans 13:13. Let us live honorably, as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarreling and jealousy. Instead, put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. That was the verse that the Holy Spirit directed his attention to. And from there, he said, the light shone. And from that day forward, he was a changed man. And so he was converted that July 386, as he recounts what happened. You can see the fruition of his struggle and what he found that day. Well, after his conversion, let me just give a brief timeline. He'll converted in 386. He'll be baptized by Ambrose. He'll go into a retreat. He'll resign his high government position and go basically into a retreat to try and regroup and to figure out what has happened. In 388, he will move to Rome to write. He will return to Thagaste 3 years for contemplation and retirement. He's going to go back and write. 3 years sounds familiar to what the Apostle Paul did after he was converted. I don't think there's any planned summary, but it happened that way. In 391, he'll become a presbyter, and from now on, he is no longer the philosopher Christian. Instead, he is going to have to deal with the practical issues of the church. He becomes a pastor, and now he's going to be able to bring all of his lessons to bear in the church. He'll be elected the Bishop of Hippo in 395, and then in 430, he dies. He'll have 39 years of ministry that we'll see next week. What do we learn from the life of Augustine? Well, there's so many things you can do. I say, at least for thought, never give up on the conversion of a lost person. As long as they have breath, they can be saved. Never say he's too far gone. Never say his sin is so great, because God will use that sin for his glory. Never give up. Monica didn't. Here's a perfect example. God was able to use Augustine's bad past for the good of the church. And oh, did he. Pelagius will fall into it headlong. The Manichaeans will find the death knell of their teaching in Augustine. He'll be able to go back and answer so thoroughly about how you deal with evil that he'll put an end to the Manichaean philosophy. Monica, don't underestimate the effect of a faithful mother on the history of Christianity. Not on a son, on the history of Christianity. She was faithful to the end, and she got the desire of her heart. She will die shortly after Augustine is saved. But there is a touching moment where, before she dies, days before she dies, before she knows she's going to get sick and die, before she's sick, she and Augustine are talking about heaven and what it's going to be like and the joys of being together in heaven. She got the fruition of what she wanted more than anything else. And she said, I believe the Lord has left me here on this earth so that I could see you at this day. Touching moment. But a mother can have an effect that will touch all of church, you and me included today. Well, we end now. I would just encourage you to come back next week. We'll talk about the practical effects of Augustine in church history. Thank you very much.